Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and this is really fun for me. I've got Dwayne Anderson here. Not quite here. He's on Zoom. Hey, Dwayne.
Hey, Jeff.
Dwayne and I met at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival just last year in 2022 because his film, 30 Meetings, 30 Days, was an official selection, and I'm just going to make him suffer and rattle off all your awards. 30 Meetings, 30 Days. One, Best Featurette Drama. Best Director, Best Lead Actress, Best Performance by a Cast, Best Screenplay, and to top it off, Best Cinematography, which I thought was extra cool. I guess I should have named, but I say Best Lead, obviously a writer and director is you, Lee. Oh, I didn't copy and paste the lead actress's name, but it's Emily Goss.
Emily Goss.
Wow, I could remember that. I must have just read it like 10 minutes ago. And your cinematographer was Bianca Klein.
Yep. Yeah.
So just an excellently made film all around. The jury just obviously ate it up. Just a brilliant film. And then Dwayne actually sent me a link to a feature he made back in, I guess, 2016, 2017 is when you finished it, I imagine.
Yeah, no, it came out in 2006. It premiered at festivals in 2016. I think it was released finally in like early 2017.
And that's called Super Powerless, so we'll be able to talk about both. I didn't confirm this with you, but Omeletto, right? If people want to watch 30 Meetings, right. 30 Days, they can just go to the Omeletto website and search for it, or go, Omeletto is essentially a YouTube channel.
Yeah, I think if you just kind of type in 30 Meetings, 30 Days movie, YouTube, Omeletto, something like that, it should come up. Yeah. I don't know. Right now we're at May 5th or something like that, and May 4th, and I don't know exactly when it's going to drop on their site.
Gotcha. Well, people can keep their eyes open for it on Omeletto. I have a lot of respect for Omeletto. In fact, I often say to myself, they're a little smarter than me, whoever runs that, because this podcast gave birth to a TV series on Amazon Prime. And boy, if I thought of the YouTube thing, it probably a lot more eyeballs be on it. But
I don't know. It's a crapshoot. Who knows? We'll see how we do.
Well, so I slipped it in. So if people are interested in indie film, and you probably should be if you're listening to this, you can go to Amazon Prime Video and search for Discover Indie Film. And currently there are 7 seasons of short films handpicked from the festival circuit. It does cost 99 cents per episode or $7.99 per season. But you are, paying $8 to see about 25 really well-made self-financed short films. So, $8 to support indie filmmakers who spent a lot more than $8 on their work is not a huge ask. We used to be free and clear with Prime, and then we climbed up to like 10,000 unique viewers a week, and they said, hey, we want you to charge instead. Because turns out it's their servers and it's their rules. I think it's fair. So anyway, no more of that. We'll just jump right into the interview part. I already warned Dwayne. I'm just going to say, I've seen 2 films now. I enjoyed... In our preamble before we started recording, I called you a storyteller because I think it's very clear that you are a storyteller, a very skilled, particularly with film. But when did you first get the storytelling bug? When did you get the hints that you were a creative?
Yeah. I always was. I mean, I always wrote stories, drew pictures. I mean, that was just what I did. I decided I would be a filmmaker at the age of 9. When I was 9 years old, a buddy and I got on a public bus. It's a totally different era. 2 9-year-olds on a public city bus, and we went to the local movie theater, and I saw my first grown-up movie. I can't say adult movie anymore because that could be confusing, but I saw my first grown-up movie. It was Silver Streak with Gene Wilder and Richard Pryor. And, for a kid who'd only seen Disney movies and stuff on TV, and I'd watch a lot of stuff on TV by then, but I had language and I had sexuality and I had violence and and it was really funny. And I thought it was the greatest thing I'd ever seen. You know, I just was so just tantalized. And I left really literally wanting to be a filmmaker. So yeah, I just want to make stuff like that. I just thought that was incredible.
And so, I love that Silver Streak is your, was your inspiration. That's for those who aren't our age. Yeah, we grew up watching movies on TV that were heavily edited, heavily all the bad words dubbed, all the interesting scenes cut out with long periods of commercials in there. Yeah, so yeah, I imagine that might have been an R-rated movie.
No, it was PG. It was pre-PG-13, but it was PG.
I don't think PG-13 existed back then, but no, I don't mean to be ticky tack.
It wasn't for a while. And it was good. I mean, there's nothing really, you know, bad about it. It's not, you know, it's not like I wouldn't, you know, it would be a mild PG-13 now, you know, but it was
sexy.
That's true. You know, and it was great. And then, so I sort of had these three pillars. So there's that. And then when I was just a couple years later, I went and saw Star Wars, and I am always like, I went with a friend. Again, these are always with friends. In fact, two of them were with the same friend. I went and saw Star Wars, and it was opening weekend on a Saturday morning, you know, like around 11. And you know, I always pity like young people now who didn't have that experience of like just the mind-blowing experience of watching Star Wars in the theater without knowing what it was, right? Just not being prepared for it and just suddenly seeing this thing, you know, it's absolutely incredible. And then a few years after that, when I was 16, the same kid that I saw Silver Streak with, he had won over the radio some tickets to the West Coast premiere in San Francisco of Ingmar Bergman's Fanny and Alexander. And so as a 16-year-old kid, I walked in there with my... It was black tie event. I was wearing blue jeans and a t-shirt, you know, and we walk in there and all of a sudden I see Fanny and Alexander, which is a 3-hour art movie. And each of those movies just sort of like completely like rocked my world as far as what the cinema experience is. And I say, those are my sort of three pillars, you know, as far as my film. I mean, there was a lot of other sort of key things in between, but
yeah. And were you like writing short stories and stuff? Were you just sort of a creative kid anyway? But
well,
then
I started making like Super 8 movies when I was like 10. Yeah. And I was always in theater, so I was acting. But I wrote my first feature length screenplay when I was 14. It was hysterical. I was in some, you know, freshman English class where she said, you get one for every page of outside writing you write, you get a certain amount of extra credit. So the next day I dropped this typed feature screenplay on her desk and she transferred me out of the class to another one. Yeah. So.
Anyway. By the way, I failed to ask a key question that popped in my head when you first talked about Silver Streak, which is, where'd you grow up?
I grew up in Palo Alto, California.
Oh, NorCal, right. Right, so the premiere in San Francisco was not that far.
No, it was just a little drive. So it's just about, what is that, a half hour south of San Francisco? Something like that, I don't remember.
Depending on traffic, but yeah, sure.
For sure.
Yeah, so you grew up in Palo Alto. Gotcha. So you're a Bay Area guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is actually, I mean, it feels like a very community, creative.
Very much.
Creativity is incurred. Like, it's not.
Very much so, with an incredible independent and art movie house scene. We could see every movie, every cool movie that came out. I mean, I remember seeing, And I went, you know, I was movie mad. So I have these great memories of like riding my bike when I was 15 to go see Raging Bull and Kagamushu, Kurosawa's Kagamushu, seeing that in the theater. And there was this great, everyone who grew up around my age, you know, 10 years after, 10 years before, or 30 years before, probably, talks about this theater, The New Varsity, which was would just show older, not older movies, like, but they weren't, you know, we didn't have video stores yet, right? And so they would just show these re-releases, and they'd curate them. They'd generally do like double features. I know we saw La Cage aux Folles 1 and La Cage aux Folles 2, you know, so they do those little sort of curated back to back. They did a late night thing once where I saw, Let It Be and, Magical Mystery Tour, you know, and things like that. And so it was just an amazing place to go. When I was a kid, I went there, and then for Ape Mania, they showed like 4 Planet of the Apes movies in a row, you know? And so just these amazingly cool film experiences. You know, everyone I talk to who grew up in that area, who's in film, you know, has like this sort of foundational, you know, formative experience. We could all talk about The New Varsity with like, oh, that was just where I was learned how to, you know, about movies, you know.
For sure. And I felt like noting, or I feel like noting, that your three pillars are such a nice balance. It's almost like Silver Streak is pure entertainment. I mean,
comedy thriller.
Pryor and Wilder, like they were one of the best comedy teams ever.
Yeah, and that was their first time they were together, and probably their best, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's right, because they should have been together in Blazing Saddles, but weren't.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, they weren't.
Yeah. And then Star Wars is pure imagination, especially seeing it at the age. Yeah, just pure world building.
Yeah.
And then Bergman, you get pure art. So it's very nice breadth.
Yeah. I love the idea of still standing on those three pillars. You know?
For sure. All right. So then at some point, you wrote a feature at 14 and you shocked your freshman English teacher and stuff. Did you major in film? Did you start seeking out film studies?
No, I didn't. I went to BYU. We were talking about BYU, which is a religious school. And that's just sort of where I was kind of urged by my family to go. And my older brother was there, and he was having a good time. So I went, but I wanted to study film, but because it was a religious school, I took the first class, and like the very first day, the teacher was kind of started ripping into how depraved the graduate was. And at the time, The Graduate was absolutely my favorite movie. It's still one of my favorite movies, but at that age, boy, The Graduate was just like the bomb.
When I was in college, I watched The Graduate over and over, including the Criterion edition, where some film studies professor was doing the commentary over every scene and pointing out everything that Mike Nichols was doing. I couldn't get enough of that.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And so I just didn't want to study film there. And I was an English major for a while because I did want to be a screenwriter, but I'm a slow reader. You know, I love reading, but I'm just slow. It takes me a while. And I knew I was going to like have to read all these books fast. I was like, there's no way I'm going to be able to do that. And so I eventually ended up being an art major. And it was in my mind at first, it was a segue to film, but then I just dug it, you know, and I kind of got into my professors. They were like, they had this like cool life where they would just paint in their time, and then show up to school, talk about paint art and look at your paintings and make a few comments and then go back to painting themselves. And I decided that's what I wanted to be. For the first time in my life since I was 9, I kind of had a different career choice, which was now I'm going to be an art professor. And so I got an MFA in art. And
And did you stay at BYU for the MFA?
No, I was at SUNY Buffalo, State University of New York at Buffalo. And then I moved to New York City to be a starving artist. And I succeeded wonderfully at the starving part. And
back when a starving artist could actually live in the city, right?
Like, no, not really. Oh. I mean, anyway, but I, you know, I was doing well. I was doing all right, and I think my career trajectory at that point was fine. If I wanted to pursue art, I couldn't get any jobs teaching because, just like teaching film, most universities don't hire someone like my brother's a political science professor, and he got his PhD and got hired to college. That's the way it works, you know. But in the fields of like art or film, you generally want somebody who can teach, who has some actual professional experience. And so I wasn't getting those jobs. And I eventually had to actually move back to Utah just as a sabbatical replacement for somebody in my program. They offered me to just come back. And we'd been in New York for about a year. I was married at the time. And so we came back, and it was just going to be a semester, but I ended up never leaving, which is crazy because as a California kid, when I came out here, I was like, oh, I hate it here. I hate the Utah, you know? And, I love it now. I mean, I just completely like kind of changed, and I love living in Utah now, but shortly after that, so I would say probably, after my graduate program, probably less than 2 years after my graduate program, I was like, I want to make movies, you know? And so, and I'd had a show in Berkeley, actually. I'd had an exhibit of my work in Berkeley, and it just didn't do anything, you know? It wasn't in a gallery, but it was in this sort of art space in a cafeteria. It was a pretty cool space. But it's like, you know, it's this stuff on the wall that people don't notice, you know? And I wanted to grab an audience. I wanted people to be sitting in seats looking at my work, you know, having to kind of be face to face with it. And I was like, I just, you know, art is incredible. I love making it. I love like the world of it. I love thinking about it, talking about it, but I just want to make movies, you know? And so, so I started screenwriting again, and then in my screenwriting, that little momentary screenwriting career actually, again, was a nice trajectory. My first thing that I wrote then, and I'd been writing all my life, you know, but the first thing that I wrote sort of, okay, now I'm going to focus on this instead of going out and painting every night, I'm going to be writing. And the first thing I wrote, I sent around, got an agent, started doing meetings. It was read by a lot of really cool people. I had a lot of really cool conversations with people about why they were not going to buy it. And eventually I wrote another one and another one. And I just kind of got impatient, you know, and I just said, oh, well, I want to make something. And so I made something. And that thing that I made was this movie based on a Soviet short story called The Old Woman. And it kind of got distributed by this company. It's still distributed by this company that really focuses on educational media. Right. And so like there's a few Russian classes throughout the country that like show this movie as part of their curriculum. And that sort of gave me confidence and got me excited about directing. But it also, I had brought in some crew. It was all like, I mean, the whole thing we shot for like a few $1,000s, right? But I brought in these young students, these like recent graduate film students to help. And they all started working crews, and they started recommending me to crews, and mostly in art departments. And so I started working crews. And then, you know, for the next 15 years or so, I was just a full-time crew person, mostly a location manager. But I was trying to produce, and I met a guy named Dave Boyle. He was a young kid, 15 years younger than I was. But you know, I immediately saw him as being someone who was super talented and really creative. And he was making a film that I came and actually helped him shoot, largely just because I just bought a cool camera and I just wanted practice on it. So I volunteered, and I'm a horrible cinematographer. And he made it, and it was horrible. And he didn't really show it to anyone, but, But there were moments of brilliance, right, that were just based on his talent, right? And so he approached me and said, and at that point, I was in my late 30s, and I had this goal of producing a feature before I was 40. And he approached me and said, hey, I got a feature script, and I've already raised some money. Would you produce it for me? And I said, yeah. I read the script, and it actually needed a good amount of work, but the third act was like some of the best stuff I'd ever read. And I said, man, this is so exciting. And so I got on and I kind of helped him with the script, but he did most of it. And that movie was called Big Dreams, Little Tokyo. And it played at a lot of festivals. It premiered at AFI and did well enough that we raised money for our second movie, even before that was done with its theatrical release. That movie was called Wine and Rice. And that was made during the financial crisis. We were shooting in 2008 as everything was just imploding. And so it didn't really, you know, the whole indie distribution scene kind of changed then. And so we kind of shifted, and we were shooting, this is my spiel, I've gone on a bit, but what happened is we were shooting pickups for that movie. And it's a movie I really like, but it just didn't really do much. And we're shooting pickups for that movie, and it was just by our cinematographer, Bill Otto, Dave, and myself. We're just shooting, like, you know, we'd done most of the editing. We're getting, like, exteriors and stuff like that. And we said, boy, this is fun. Wouldn't it be fun if we just, like, made a whole movie this way? And so since no one had any money at that point to invest in anything, we made a movie called Surrogate Valentine. That we made for like 15 grand, and it played at South by Southwest, and that movie really launched Dave's career. We made a sequel to that within a year, just because the guy who gave us the $15,000 thought it was so much fun, he just gave us another $15,000 just to do another one. And then, you know, and Dave Boyle he made a movie called Man from Reno, which I helped with, but didn't get a credit. I got some credit on him, but I wasn't really his main producer. And that was nominated for an Independent Spirit Award. And now he's shooting a big Netflix series in Japan. He's bilingual, and so he's shooting it in Japan. And during that time, after I started making things with Dave, a bunch of other people, you know, I started doing a lot of line producer work and so that was sort of my indie career.
I have a question that I hope it doesn't derail you too much, which is, were you in Utah the whole time for all
that?
Yeah,
I was in Utah the whole time.
I mean, I'm just going to add, it's kind of extra impressive to get all that done away from LA in a way, you know?
Utah actually has a pretty cool indie scene. Lots of movies are made here. And it also has a kind of a Hollywood scene. So there's lots of people who come here to make movies, you know? So I was working on those crews and learning stuff, but I eventually started working a lot in LA as well as San Francisco. To the point that I was getting hired as a local in both places, you know, where people were just kind of hiring me and then finding out later I didn't actually live there.
Right. They were like Dwayne's always around. Let's bring him in. Because once people know you're good and they can trust you.
Yeah. And that actually, you know, a couple of big projects, like there was this project with the Duplass brothers that I was brought on to be a producer for. And I was like, oh man, this is awesome. And then they found out I didn't live there. And I was like, oh, wait a minute, we need you there. And there was another project that was a really big project. It was actually a Greg Araki project that he wanted me on, and then found out I didn't live there. And I hadn't shot there yet. I at that point, that was based on White and Rice. He saw White and Rice and brought me on as a potential producer. I can't remember the name of the film it was. It was had a funny name. It played at Cannes, played at Sundance, but I wasn't part of it. But it was good because I'd only shot like a few days in LA, And later I produced several movies that were just strictly in LA, and, you know, I had a lot to learn. And so I was glad. And not only that, but in our interviews, I probably shouldn't say this because, but it's not Greg's fault. And I haven't said the name of the film. So, but they got flipped, right? They were non-union. And I remember saying, this is a pretty big project for non-union, and I'm not really comfortable doing that in LA, even though I didn't even know. But my instinct was telling me that that was a bad idea. And they did get flipped, which is something that I've had, you know, I've known several people I've happened to, but I've always avoided. And so, so I've been able to avoid it. Anyway, I mean, so anyway, but during all that time, I was a producer. And one of the things that kind of happened to me was, you know, I made that one for short, that first film. It was kind of a weird film. It was like 50 minutes long. So it doesn't really fit in any category. That first, that's one that's now used for education. But then I made a second film that that was a short. And I remember coming home to my wife and saying, I was directing both of those. I said, I don't know what I'm doing as a director. I don't feel very comfortable, but I really am good at the producing stuff. And so that was really my focus until very recently. And the change is that I now am a full-time teacher. So I was hired to start teaching film. And, you know, I don't have to gig. I don't have to, like, get on as a line producer anywhere. And I could just sort of focus on my own creative stuff.
Yeah, so when you got into teaching, that was after all the...
Yeah, that wasn't
all the hustling and yeah, not, I mean, not like you were hustling, but all the working on variety of projects,
I had been
sometimes line producer, sometimes producer, sometimes this, sometimes that.
Yeah, I'd been crewing. I'd crewed for about 14, 15 years. And then from my 40s to by the time I was 50, I'd produced a lot of movies. I'd produced like maybe a dozen features, most of them really, really small. They always like did really well at festivals. I've had, you know, films at all the big festivals and stuff, but they just, none of them really ever made any money because they were all such small films, you know. And so I always had to, like, you know, make a living editing and doing other gigs, you know. And the teaching job came along really accidentally. I didn't plan on it, but the school nearest my home happened to also have like the best program as far as like, you know, hands-on production. So that's the program where I would always bring out interns and stuff, and always had a really great experience. And that was Utah Valley University. And one day in one of those lulls of freelance, right, when it just nothing seemed to be clicking, I was on Indeed and I saw that they were hiring a full-time faculty person. So I thought, well, I've got the MFA from painting, but whatever. And I just submitted everything, and they ended up, it's the biggest surprise of my life that they hired me. And so, but that's been, you know, now like during the writer's strike and stuff, I just, you know, I'm constantly telling myself, man, I'm really lucky to have this full-time gig.
Well, it sounds like getting the gig at the university meant that you could breathe and start thinking about the kind of director, kind of storyteller you want to be.
Yeah, absolutely. It was good to have a day job, especially since, you know, I've never made any money doing it. I really haven't. I mean, I've been paid, but I've never had that like big, I've never like really crashed the Hollywood gates. I did this, you know, I recently submitted to the Nichols Fellowship. So that's in process, right? And I did that years ago with a film, and I became like a, I don't know, one of the finalists. I made like at least the first oop, I think, which is, and that was over a decade ago. It was maybe more than that. Jeez, it was probably like 20 years ago. I've been writing ever since, but I haven't submitted because I know that there's like this cap on how much money you can have made as a writer. And I've made, you know, $1,000 here, $1,000 there, being hired to write. People have hired me to write stuff. Dave Boyle and I wrote a project together that we were paid a little bit for, right? And then And then the so I said, I wonder how much it is. I think it's like 5,000, and I know I've done more than 5,000. And I looked, and it's like 20,000 or something like that. And I was like, oh, well, I've never done 20. I've never made 20. I've never made that much. I mean, maybe I've made 10, but I've never made 20. So, you know, over years of writing, you know, and so I've never quite, like, you know, had that payday, even a payday that's like union scale. And so,
yeah, and probably a lot, well, I'm projecting here, I guess, but probably a lot of the stuff where you'd have something good and someone would not install, I shouldn't put it that way, but, like, you know, those $1 options and things that make you think that there's a chance.
Yeah.
Writers don't see a lot until it's like winning the lottery.
Yeah, it's until it's made. Not even option or even being filmed until, like, the film is made. But it's also one of those things where the thing that you learn is, in Hollywood, you can have a lot of really exciting things going on without anything happening at all. You know, so you can have movies that people are talking about and having all these meetings and you feel like this, something's happening, and then
names attached. Production scale. I actually have I certainly won't name him, but just yesterday, a friend told me he just had two things die yesterday, because of the strike, I guess. But, two things that he thought he was actually going to get a payday because it had names attached and this and that and blah, blah, blah. And he called all depressed. I think it was actually day before yesterday, but yeah, you can be right there feeling like, oh my God, really? Really? And then nothing.
Yeah. And so there's this sort of Zen thing that, and we were talking about being older before we started, and, you know, I think we're about the same age. I'm in my just beyond mid 50s.
Yeah. And I think based upon the ages you gave when
I was seeing those films,
you are my older brother's age. We're 2 years apart. So,
yeah.
So basically, lived in the same world.
And here's the deal is, you know, I mean, I'm sure most people listening to your podcasts are a lot younger than I am. And they're who I was when I was in college and in my 20s and then in my 30s. And the thing about it is, everyone I know who stopped making movies, right? But everyone that I know who has kept making movies has found some sort of success, you know? And so that's really what it's about, is you just keep going. I mean, I've been able to succeed based on, you know, I mean, I've already just said I've never really made a lot of money on it, but if you look at my career and my IMDb and whatever that is, and you know, just the cool things I've gotten to do, I've had an awesome career. I've had a lot of fun. I've made a lot of really cool movies, you know, and
you figured out a way to have food and board by teaching.
Yeah. And I have a family, it's not like you're home, and you know, all these good things. And so I kind of have it really good. And so you kind of have to get to this Zen place where it's about the work, you know, where it's about just, yeah, I make movies because I love making movies, and that's how I express myself. And it's not about being famous, you know, because that is, everyone I know who is successful, who, what I call successful, who has a career in the film industry, none of them are where they want to be, you know? I mean, Martin Scorsese struggles to get a movie made. So, you know, I mean, everyone I know, I know guys who are really, like, famous, you know, who, you know, it's not like they can just say, hey, I got a new idea, let's go into production. You know, it's really hard.
Not unless they happen to be able to self-finance or make it micro budget. Yeah. No, you're totally, I mean, it's I don't think I've said this on a podcast before, but I met a dude at a barbecue once. We were talking about writing, and this is like 20 years ago. And he was impressed that I had something that had actually gone somewhere. He had nothing go anywhere, but is super talented. It's Dan Harmon, who, you know, did Community and Rick and Morty and stuff. But he was like, I wrote this animation script and Spielberg and Geffen love it. And I had this meeting with them and Spielberg looked me in the eyes and said, I love this. I wish we could get it made. But, you know, whatever, they had a release deal through Universal or whatever for SKG. And he's like, he basically was telling me, yeah, even if Spielberg wants to make it, it's not up to him.
Yeah.
Like, even that level, people are like, I would love to make this, but I can't. You know, it's not going to happen. Someone else said no.
So when I had this incredible experience when I was in college, I I was doing this contemporary art class, and me being me, I had to write a paper on somebody, and the guy I wanted to write about, I actually just wrote and you know, got in contact with. And instead of just, you know, so we ended up becoming, you know, acquainted. And so I could just interview him and stuff like that instead of just reading out of books, because that's sort of the guy I am. But I went out to New York and we were hanging out, and he was saying, yeah, you know, he was really hot shot for a while there in the 80s. And he was saying, but you know, the work isn't selling, so I don't know what to do. And he was pretty vulnerable to this college kid, right? I'm not sure what to do. And I remember looking at him and I was like, well, you just keep making work. I mean, I didn't say that, but it's like, the work isn't selling, I don't know what to do. You do what you were doing before the work is selling. You just keep making stuff, you know? I mean, isn't that why we're an artist? Is it to sell stuff or is it to make stuff? And I think Picasso has this great thing that he said, where someone asked him, what do you do when inspiration doesn't come? He says, well, I just make sure that I'm painting so that when it does come, I'm working, you know? And so I think the secret is just to keep doing stuff, you know, and just to keep making stuff and just to keep writing and shooting and doing whatever you can to like feel to be improving and to be creative, you know.
Well, and you're doing it, it's my opinion that you're doing it the right way and you're doing it for the right reasons. Lord knows, living in LA, I was born and raised here. So I've met many, many people who are like, you know, moved to LA to make it in the film business and, you know, meet them somewhere. And they're like, you know, I really want an office on the studio lot.
Right.
And I was like, why? Well, because I want to write films. And I'm like, shouldn't you write the films first before you start dreaming about driving a Range Rover onto the Sony lot? Like they just... Their goal wasn't artistic. Their goal was status, you know?
And that's one of the things that I've kind of figured out. One of the things I look back at is when I see that, you know, I think about that script that I had that kind of got tossed around town and talked about, and is I think the worst thing that could have happened to me was that I had sold that script. Because even that sold and was the big buzz script. Well, the next script I wrote was actually really terrible. You know, it was really terrible because I didn't really know what I was doing yet. Right. And so what happens all the time is somebody, you know, gets their agent when they're in their 20s and sells a script, gets on a TV show, whatever, whatever. But they're still learning their craft. Right. But they're learning their craft on the job, which is tricky, because if somebody says, well, this guy sucks, I'm going to fire him, let's bring in somebody else. And then they get that happen again. And then that happens again. Well, it's hard to learn your craft on your job when you're getting fired all the time because you don't know your craft. And then you start saying, well, this one worked, right? So, and this is selling. So it starts becoming, I have to write so that I'm getting hired, right? And then that's kind of like a losing game, because it's really hard to ever guess where the hit's going to be, right? And so then it's just kind of a tricky thing. And some people figure it out and are really good at it, but other people don't. There's other people that we all know who, you know, were hot for a while, but then they weren't ever to sustain it. And I think, you know, for me, I feel like, I don't know who I am to say this, but I feel like, well, you know, I mean, writing now is feels like second nature, you know. And no one's buying my scripts, you know, but I just, you know, I feel like I'm as good as I've ever been, and you know, that I'm just getting started, you know, which is a weird place to be because, you know, no one wants to hire a 50-year-old anyway, but it's still like this, you know, it's just like, I feel very comfortable and competent with my craft right now. And I've had the luxury of learning it, without having to, you know, justify myself through salary in a way, you know. Anyway,
for sure, especially in this last my short-term memory is weak, but you know, it sounds like you've got nearly a decade at the university. Or
no, I just almost a decade, not quite. Yeah
So in that time you've really been able to focus on the work and the art instead of the chase.
Right. And you also learn by teaching, because suddenly you're talking about something and it makes you think about, oh, it'd be really interesting if, you know, what if I made a movie this way, you know, in a
For
way
sure.
that you might not be thinking about if you're not like kind of thinking about some of these concepts. I mean, I'm a much better director because I've taught directing than I was before I'd ever taught directing, you know.
Well, I think you just gave me a great segue to mention 30 meetings, 30 days, because I remember from the Q&A that you wrote that script and made that film because you gave yourself a challenge, right? Like a...
Yeah. Yeah.
All medium shots, I think.
As far as promoting the film, we probably should have started with all this stuff. We've bored our audience so much that if they're still here for 30 meetings, 30 days, then I'm really appreciative.
I have it on very good authority that there are at least 5 people who love this.
Excellent.
Just, no, I'm kidding. But no, it's really, honestly, I don't mean to distract from the subject, but podcasts are, I think they're popular because the lost art of conversation. Like, we don't have real world conversations as much as we'd all like anymore because of these stupid phones and screens and computer. Like,
I never thought of it that way.
Yeah. So I think people really enjoy listening to genuine conversations where everyone, like, we put our phones on do not disturb and we actually talk about stuff that we care about, and it's pleasurable. So I think we've still got people listening.
Cool. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it. 30 meetings, 30 days came about because I was thinking, and again, this thought came, you know, related to teaching, that the hardest cut to make is a cut between a medium shot of one person to a medium shot of the same person, whether they're just in the same setting or in a different setting. That's a cut that generally doesn't work. And I thought, huh, that's interesting. What would it be if I made a movie that was entirely made out of those cuts? And that was the whole premise of the movie, really, artistically, was that every shot is pretty much going to be of a medium shot of the same person. And I thought of that idea, and I started, and almost immediately I thought that it would be a woman going through AA. And I have experience with abusive, self-abusive behavior, and I understand AA, and I'm not an alcoholic, but I've been through a lot of therapy and stuff that's like has brought me to kind of like 12-step programs and stuff like that, all the way into my childhood, where, you know, my dad sort of did some sort of counseling with people and stuff like that. Anyway, but there was a world. Somebody asked me, well, what research did you do for it? And I was like, oh, I didn't do any research. My life, unfortunately, has been the research. But the reason for that was because I knew she would be listening to people, and I knew And I knew I also wanted to isolate her in a way. And I wanted like everything to happen kind of outside of the frame of the story itself. So often she's in a meeting and she's just listening to someone, but also the key events of the story itself, such as her alcoholism, the DUI that kind of sent her to court, her court rulings, her all these different things that kind of happen. We kind of see her preparing for them and then we see the result, but we don't really see the event itself. And so so it's like she's kind of, the audience is kind of isolated from these events and has to fill in those gaps. And she's kind of in a box separate from things. And so that was sort of all came together aesthetically pretty quick. I wrote the script in pretty much a night and then I tweaked it a few times, you know. And then really the reason it got made was because of my cinematographer, Bianca Klein, who I'd worked with and who I think is brilliant. And I wanted, you know, I'd worked with as a producer. And so I sent it to her and she was like, oh, we've got to make this. You know, she was like, really like, I'm 100% on board. I was like, oh my gosh, I could direct a movie with Bianca as my DP. And that was just such a privilege and such a exciting opportunity that I just said, okay, I'm pulling out money from my savings and my, I'm getting a new credit card and I'm going to make a movie, you know, and it'd been a long time because between Super Powerless, which was 2016 and 30 Days, which we shot in May of 21. There, I hadn't really made anything.
Yeah. And Super Powerless had been, a 4 to 8 year process for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, that had been the shoot. It had been a while. And so I'd made little things here and there, and I had a couple things that happened is I had a big, we're just like exactly what we're talking about. I had a big project, you know, that had actors attached and everything for a script I'd written and directed and you know, a lot of love about it, but just no one wanted to give us any money for it. And that was 10 years. So it was like 10 years of my life in development on this thing, you know? And then another project where, I spent 2 years, it was a documentary series that I spent 2 years working with the directors as their main producer. And we finally got it to a company that got it to Netflix and it got green lit. But once that company and Netflix were involved, they have all their own producers, you know, all with more, some with more doc experience and others with less, but you know, they all wanted to have their thing. And suddenly I was like the odd man out and I do not have a credit. And it came out, I do not have a credit on the film though, but it was 2 years of pre-production for not really getting to be part of the movie. And I walked off, I didn't get fired. I just felt like it wasn't really ever my project. It was, you know, it was, I was not the author of it. You know, it was a project that my friend was very passionate about and I love, you know, supporting them, my friends. And so it was just kind of like, I've been regulated to less and less and less. And to the point of like, you know, I had found a lot of the people who we were interviewing for this documentary and had nursed these relationships for a couple of years. And then I was going to go to lunch with one of them and I was told I can't, you know, and I'm not allowed to talk to them without one of the other producers. And I was like, wait a minute, you know, so it was just like, you know, I just don't even want to be here anymore. And so I just resigned and they were offering me a credit that I said no. Now I probably, you know, I question that, but not really.
I hate that story, actually. I have a memory of something. I had something similar happen where I was actually told something was moving forward and I was like, all right, I'm going to invite so-and-so to lunch. I think we should like sit down and talk because we're going to work together. And I was told, don't. Yeah. His agent doesn't want you talking to him. Something like that. And it was why?
Yeah, that sort of thing. And there's just this thing where in the industry, you know, people really want control. And, you know, and when, and it's one of those sort of things where, you know, they don't want, if you're not really on the project, you don't get to know what's going on. You don't get to know get to come in and give notes on the edit and stuff like that. And I get that, and that's the way the industry is, but it was like, this is my project. You know, this this is, you know, I set up this, we set up this LLC together, you know, to start this thing, you know, and all of a sudden I'm not on it, you know, and it was just kind of, it was one of those little feelings where you're in school and suddenly your best friend starts playing with someone new and you're not, you know, when you're a kid and you're jealous because they've got a new friend, you know, it's that sort of thing.
Yeah. But, who are they to be with that? Even if you like that person, you're like, no, I don't like him now, but.
Yeah. Well, I chose to walk off. I thought about it a long time and I made a choice. And the only time that I've ever really sort of regretted that choice is when it came out and everyone was talking about it. But then 6 months later, no one's talking about it anymore, you know, and it's
That's true. Things don't have the shelf life they used to.
They don't. Yeah. And so, you know, and it's just, you know, it was a little emotionally challenging when people were saying, have you seen this? And I was like, yeah, I saw it. It's great, isn't it? Yeah, it's great. Yeah. And then you have a little emotional like thing. I want to say that.
Yeah. You want to jump and go, by the way, but
yes.
Let me interrupt you and shift your gears back to 30 meetings.
Right. I like talking to you, Jeff.
Because it's an artistic triumph, I'll just say that. Like it's besides the way the challenge you gave yourself with the medium shots and you wanted to work with Bianca Klein, the cinematographer, but also brilliant cast.
It's just
brilliant. Cool. I mean, it feels like all the pieces for that came together wonderfully, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Bianca, I think the other movie or one of the other things she shot shortly after she shot my movie was Marcel Lachelle with Shoes On. And so that was kind of her big, now she's like studio person. Now she's like shooting big stuff. So that was a great moment for her. Yeah. It came together really well, really quick. We just got great people on all sides. And that was really it. It was about me wanting to work with all of my favorite craftspeople, you know, so the editor, the sound team, the cinematographer, I mean, the sound designer who also did our production sound, and the re-recording mixer is a guy I've worked with as a producer. Well, he also did Super Powerless, but they're guys who, you know, who are just like my favorite people to work with. And so, you know, Super Powerless was about making a movie with a friend of mine, right? Joe and Amy, the two stars of that movie, are lifelong friends. In fact, Joe, Josiah, who played Bob in Super Powerless, was the guy I was with when I went and saw Star Wars when we were
really
10, yeah, or 11. And so, and at the end of that movie, I just have this little slogan that says, make movies with your friends. And there's a little picture. If you wait to the very end of the credits, there's a little video from our very first day of shooting a movie when we were 10 years old, myself and several other friends.
Son of a bitch. I stopped during the credits.
Yeah.
I didn't see it.
Waited a little bit. There's a shot and there's some guys there. And a couple of those guys actually appear in the movie. They're extras in the background at one point. But
I have to say, now it makes sense to me because I didn't know you were a Bay Area person, but it's also a bit of a love letter to the Bay Area, I think.
For sure. We go back to Palo Alto and we go to some of our real places. But anyway, in 30 meetings, 30 days, it was very similar. I mean, I was just working with people were working for nothing. I mean, they were doing all me a favor, you know, because I wasn't paying anyone very well. But it was just about working with my favorite people and the artists that I most admired. Now, as far as Emily goes, she submitted, her agent submitted her application. We had 2,000 people submit for the part. And she had she had sort of a step above everyone because I knew her. I knew her work. I didn't know her personally, but I knew I'd seen two films that she had been in, including one that had been directed by a friend of mine. And so I auditioned some really great actors and people I've stayed in touch with actually, because I want to work with again or at some point. But you know, Emily, I knew what I was going to get in Emily. I knew she was going to be fantastic. And I knew just from you, if you watch her body of work, she's all in, you know, she's all in on everything she does. And so I called my friend and she was like, yes, definitely work with Emily. And she really was. She was so great. And she was, I mean, she had to go because we do 30 days in 20 minutes. And so she goes from one, you know, 10 second shot of totally high to another 10 second shot of totally low. And a lot of it's shot in order, you know, I mean, based on location, but we shot, what is it? Not consecutively. We shot, what's that called when you shoot in order?
Synchronous?
No. Anyway, but we shot in order, like in the house, and we shot in order in the AA room, and we shot in order, you know, in our locations. And so there were times when she was like this low and this high in the very next shot, the very next setup, right? And she, yeah, she pulled it off. She nailed it. Why she isn't like making giant movies, I don't know. You know, I think if you are listening to this, you should look up Emily Goss and cast her immediately.
For sure. And as you said about the medium shots and everything, I mean, it's always her face, often in silence, still completely communicating what's going on inside. Right. It's actually very internal. Her story is very internal, which I always think that might be another challenge. I don't know if that maybe that wasn't the challenge you gave yourself, but I always, you know, one funny thing to me about screenwriting is, you know, if you read a lot of novels, we're always inside people's heads. And in film, you know, unless you lean on voiceover,
right,
you can't, you know, nothing's worse actually than when a friend gives you a screenplay to read and it's about internal conflict and they don't pull it off. Cause you're like, yeah, guess what? You didn't write a movie, but her performance is so amazing because, you know, even, you know, I love the scene with the children when the children actually kind of go off screen and we're still on her face and we see the pain. We see so much.
Yeah. She's so good at that. And that was really what I was auditioning for. We did this. One of my favorite things in any acting performance is watching an actor listen. Watching an actor listen to somebody else. And it's something really noticeable when you're editing films, when you see an actor who is as interesting to look at when they're listening as it is when they're talking. And some aren't. Some just kind of go vacant when they're, you know, or they just, you know, they're just like parried like a bird looking at whoever's listening, but you don't get anything from them.
Yeah, they're getting ready for their next line.
Right. Yeah. And so that's something that I've done a lot of casting. I've worked as a producer for low budget films. I've generally was the casting director as well. And so, I've always thought about that because I've thought when they're reading and they're reading off of a reader, really in an audition, it's all about their lines and it's all about their delivery and it's not about their listening. And I knew in this movie it had to be different. And so we actually did this in our casting session. We narrowed down from 2000 to about 20 people, right? Actually, it was about 15 people that we were going to look at. And in that audition, and we warned them about this, but I had a really great actress, Amy Prosser, who plays Mimi in Super Powerless. I had her at the audition. It was all on Zoom. And I had given her a monologue from Michael Keaton's movie Clean and Sober. And that Michael Keaton does. And I gave it to Amy. And I had Amy read it. And I had this monologue read by my reader, and their assignment, the auditionee, was to listen. And we sat there in the audition. That was a big part of their audition, was listening to this monologue. And I gave them direction. I said, at first, you're resistant, you don't want to be here, but then at some point, something clicks, and you start to really listen to them. And then we would just watch. And that was like one of the most exciting things I've ever done in an audition. And most of the people auditioning agreed, you know, said the same thing. They said that was so cool. And because that's such a critical acting skill and one that I knew I needed in this. And so that was really a big part of the audition.
And that's so cinematic, really.
Yeah.
But, you know, stage plays, it's almost impossible, right? Live acting, it's almost impossible to look away from the speaker,
right?
You know, and as you pointed out, well, you didn't say it, but, you know, the laziest editing is just going from speaker to speaker to speaker to speaker. So focusing on that cinematic moment of human reaction in silence.
Yeah. Yeah. And Emily was very good at that. I had these little tricks I had planned, little things to kind of, you know, that were kind of off script, but were a way to kind of convey the emotion she was supposed to be hearing. And she didn't like that. I could tell right away that that was not her style. And she already had she already knew what she wanted to do in each of those situations. And we talked about it, you know, and we had talked about it in advance, but I didn't need to do much. And we didn't even need to like sometimes read lines off screen or whatever. She could just give me those different emotions. And so, yeah, she was amazing. And she's super awesome. Plus, she's a brilliant writer and director herself. She has a short film called The Little House in Aberdeen that played at a lot of festivals that is just amazing. Yeah.
You know, I hear that a lot these days. That's one of the joys of doing this podcast is I get to get a little more insight. People share things with me. And I think those actors who give writing and directing, you know, a shot, whether it's their goal or whether they're doing it for a lark or whatever. And I think most directors I talk to really appreciate those actors who appreciate what it's like to be on the other side.
Yeah. Yeah. Always. Because filmmaking is a collaboration and you're working with all these artisans, you know, in their different crafts. And it's really nice when the actors themselves understand the nuances of filmmaking, right? And they really get sort of movies, you know? And so it's really nice to work with actors who are really devoted to film, as opposed to actors who are just like, you know, I'm a theater actor, but I'll do film too. And it's interesting because, you know, I love actors and I love theater myself too, but you know, there's something geeky about film that when an actor is like, you know, passionate about the filmmaking process, you know, I think that makes the working experience really great. If it doesn't necessarily make their performance better, but I think it could, you know,
for sure. Well, and especially the situation you're in where I'm sure 30 meetings was shot fairly quickly.
We shot for 3 days.
Yeah. So 20 minutes in 3 days, that's actually reasonable. It's not like a breakneck pace, but it's not like you were going to be able to offer her, you know, 20 takes.
She needed to be on every time and she went all and, you know, and she's on, I mean, she's pretty much on screen the whole movie. And so, so yeah, it was a physical challenge to her, but she talks about in one of our Q&As, somebody asked her about like acting with a camera right in your face. Cause there's some shots where we, you know, Bianca said, you know, shooting, you know, these wide angle shots with the camera really close to people make the actor uncomfortable. And that was like intentional. It's like that. So that's a good thing. So let's do that. And Emily, however, said that she really likes that. She really likes like interacting with the camera as part of her performance, you know, being aware of the camera and actually doing specific things based on where the camera is at that moment and stuff. And so that's really, you know, just, I mean, top shelf type stuff.
It is. It's so impressive because, oh, Lord knows when you're involved, especially at the indie level. Sometimes, you know, actors who are wonderful in auditions and wonderful this and wonderful that, when you put a crew around and a camera, so different. It's so,
yeah.
And it's interesting because I've seen so many people crumble in that situation.
Yeah. And there's people who are so good. You know, one of my favorite filmmakers is Sean Baker. And so much of his movies are with non-actors, you know, Tangerine and Florida Project, and even going back to like Prince of Broadway and stuff, almost always he's working with like non-actors, and he's able to really pull that out in them, because he's able to boil it down to a real life situation and what you would do in that situation, and kind of make the camera go away. And then you see others, and it's just like the worst acting, you know, the horrible, it's just horrible, you know? And so it's really about approach, you know, it's really about approach from the director. And that's the director's responsibility, is making sure, because you could work with, you know, someone who's like really like professional and trained classical type actor that needs a lot of like, okay, I need you to tone it down. I need you to tone it down. And you sort of stop. That's not what you would say, but, and then someone like a child who you need to just make sure it's completely real and they're in their own world, you know, in the same scene. And so that's the responsibility for the director to kind of be aware of both those needs and be, you know, making that work.
It really is. It really is. It's funny. I'll share it because I think you'll appreciate it. But I was lucky enough to go to before Traffic came out, I got to go to an IFP screening of it. And Soderbergh was doing a Q&A afterwards. And he said, my first priority as director is to create like a velvet lined slide that the actor can get in and go right where they need to go. Like my number one job is to make their job easy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not every director's attitude is assisting, you know, is being there for the actor. Some, you know, whatever, I guess the obvious comparison is like Hitchcock, who is like, you know, treat them like kids. But yeah, it's, right.
Kurosawa said that actors are puppets, you know, and, that was one of the reasons why I really wanted to do 30 Days was to practice that, because I hadn't done it since Super Powerless. And that was one of my regrets, is not really reading different actors and the way they worked and adjusting my directing to make their performance better and get what I wanted and to be excited about what they were giving me. I was much more into just, you know, it's the first time I'd really directed anything of any of length. And I wasn't doing that yet. I wasn't learning that. And so I was so hyper aware of that when I was doing 30 days, 30 meetings, 30 days, that I was really proud of myself that early on in day one, I got that resistance from Emily, and I was pushing her a lot. But I could tell this is not her thing. This is not what she wants to do. This is not the way she wants to do it. And I was able to pivot. And that I was proud of. I was like, yes, this is exactly what I wasn't doing before. And now I know, and I can do it. And I did it. And it was great, you know, and it paid off. So
it did. And you had I believe you had a fairly superb festival run.
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to define that. You know, you talk to people who played at hundreds of festivals and.
Well, that means they spent $20,000 on submissions.
Yeah, because I think the acceptance rates of percentage is kind of always about the same. I don't know. I played at some good festivals. We premiered at Woods Hole, which was fantastic. Really liked being at your festival there in Sherman Oaks. We recently were at Cleveland, which was sort of the biggest festival we were in, and we won, and that was just a great experience. Your festival was my favorite Q&A by far that I've ever had. So everyone, Sherman Oaks, you got to submit. But also Cleveland was so much fun for like the camaraderie of the filmmakers. That's what I told people when we left, that I felt like I was, you know, when I got home, I felt like I'd just come home from camp. You know, you go to camp and you're kind of popular. You make all these new friends and everything. You feel like, you know, you feel like important. And then you come home and your life isn't nearly as interesting. And you're not nearly as popular, you know? And so we won a cool award at Cleveland. It was called the Ophelia Award. And it was an award that they give out every year that is dedicated to, it's an audience award. So it's a, you know, they take the films that kind of were in the, he said the top 20% of the audience award voting. And they do an award, and it's an award dedicated in the honor of a young woman who died of an overdose or something like that in her 20s, some addiction related sort of thing. And it's called In Celebration of Hope. And it's not just about films that have to do with addiction and recovery. It's just about a film that is presenting hope, right?
Right. Something. Yeah. There's a message of hope.
But my film actually was about recovery and addiction, and so it was sort of perfect, and it was really great. It was really
and
cool.
It has the loveliest of endings, I'd say. We don't have to give stuff away, but. It certainly, you know, I think often the power of a film is how that last feeling felt.
Yeah.
And 30 meetings, 30 days, you know, for, you know, it's a rough ride with her at times. And you certainly give us the anxiety at times. And actually, yeah, your actor who joined you on stage for the Q&A, I have her name, Becca Pruitt. Okay.
Yeah.
She was so funny criticizing her own character for being,
being the femme fatale.
I'm like, it wasn't you. It really wasn't you. Yeah. I forget where I was going with that, but yeah, it was, for a rough ride, it ends up, you know, honestly, very, so hopeful. So,
yeah, we have that. We have the. It ends with that long dolly out, right? Which the whole movie has been in medium since that's the first time we've seen any sort of wide shot at all. And you know, the movie's kind of long. It's like 20 minutes, and that dolly out's a couple minutes long. It's a long shot, you know. And we're like, you really want to end a short film with this long dolly shot, you know? And I remember. Texting Bianca, my DP, saying, we're considering cutting out the dolly shot at the end. And she texts back, don't you dare.
I was like, I'm so glad, because I mean, I'm about to like get all whatever-y with you and say, like, it's just the brilliant final shot, because her level of discomfort through the whole process and being forced, you know, court ordered AA meetings, yeah. And that dolly out is like, you give the audience the sense of relief that she just got in that last moment. And it's just it's cinema. It's storytelling through picture and sound, you know?
And I think it really wouldn't have worked if we didn't include it. And then we did that thing with all the voices. That's sort of what I would call a symphony of voices that plays over that, which to me kind of helped justify the long dolly, because you're actually listening, you know, if you're listening to these different people and you're kind of caught up in what they're saying, and so you're not like kind of like what, you know, if it was just a quiet dolly and we were just listening to one person or music or something, I don't think it would have worked. And so we made it work.
For sure. For sure. And, you know, it's wonderful that it's going to be on Amuleto, where I think in general, a lot of people get their eyeballs on Amuleto. Yeah. So
yeah,
it'll get the views it deserves.
We're trying to push it out to like recovery groups and hoping that they're going to share it that maybe up the numbers a little bit with that.
Yeah, and since Amuleto's not exclusive, down the road it'll hopefully be part of the Discover Indie Film family and get on there for
let's for people plan
to,
on it.
Yeah, people to see it. And you know, I got to stop doing stuff like this, but like, If you had a Daddy Warbucks in your life, if there's like, I feel like 30 meetings, 30 days is the kind of film that if you had, you know, $25,000 to throw at one of those Oscar publicists, there's those publicists that their job is specifically to get short films to the short film committee. Yeah. Like, I feel you would have. I think I've been around long enough, because I've watched, I mean, you know, 10 years of film festival stuff, and I've seen the films that can afford that publicist and the ones that can't, And like, you know, they make top 20, top 10 of that best live action short Oscar list. And, you know, it's this is my way of saying it's horribly corrupt that you actually just have to spend money to get considered. But I think if this film had been under the noses of said jury members, you know, it's just high quality.
I think it's such a slow, you know, it starts very, it's a strange film. It's an art film, right? I don't say it's an art film, but it's experimental. It's certainly experimental. And it felt experimental when we were making it. And so I'm not surprised that there are people who when it doesn't get programmed, for instance, because I just think people will say, I'm not sure what I just watched, you know, or if they're not really paying attention to it, you know, they put it on and they're kind of checking their texts and stuff like that. They might just like not even know what this is.
Yeah.
So it kind of requires a little dedication.
A little bit. And you need the people who don't, who care more about quality than running time, yeah, I guess is what I'll say.
I'll tell you who the best reactions. I mean, I've gotten a lot of audiences say that they love it, but the people who really love it are film people. The filmmakers love it because obviously there's a lot of craft there and there's a lot of sort of thought into the craft, and the filmmakers get it and they see what's going on, and they tend to, I mean, that's all of my biggest praise has come from my peers, which is great. Yeah,
for sure. Well, does it make you, are you writing all the time? Do you have ideas, or do you wait for inspiration?
No, I'm like Picasso. I'm gonna make sure that I'm
right.
I actually just wrote a script last night, a short script that I just got really excited about. I mean, I wrote the rough draft. I wrote 9 pages of rough draft last night. I have several things going on right now. I have 2 features that are out there trying to be discovered. I mentioned I entered one to the Nichols Fellowship, and the other I entered to the Austin screenplay competition. I haven't really done those before. It's a new thing for me, and so I've got both those out, and I'm not, you know, really holding my breath. But that's, you know, hopefully I can get somewhere. I kind of need at this point for both the scripts and manager, because they're not micro budget things. They're things that people need to look at. And then I have another feature that, and a short that I've written that really requires the approval of who it's about. Right. So it's sort of based on a true story, and I've written it, and I'm building up a proposal package to this person who's a public figure. And if I'm told that they like it, then I might be able to make it. But I might just as easily be told, nah, don't do this. I'm asking permission, right, from this person. So we'll see on that one. And then I just mentioned this script that I had an idea for yesterday that I spent stayed up till 2 a.m. writing, that I'm excited about, based for the very first time on a very autobiographical personal thing. I've never written like that before, where the main character is me at 16. And I've given him a different name, but I kept writing Dwayne. I kept having to go back and change it. No, it's not Dwayne, it's D. And so, you know, that's down the line, and who knows with that. But I do have, I'm just starting a feature that I'm producing with my friend Josiah Paul Hemus, who was the lead in Super Powerless. And this is a very interesting film. It's called Evergreen and the Effing Spectrum. And it's co-written with my friend Josiah, who teaches at a film school or a performing arts school that for people with disabilities. So it's written with him by a guy who is neurodiverse on the autistic spectrum, and he's really brilliant. And he's written this great script, and he's going to direct it. And we're not sure exactly how this is going to look, but Josiah is going to co-direct, just to kind of give him the support and the experience. And I'll be producing. And we're just setting it up. I'm meeting with my lawyer next week to set up an LLC, and we're going to try to raise money purely through a fiscal sponsor, because it's not the sort of movie that's going to make a ton of money, nor is it one that investors are going to be like, ooh, this is going to make me money. You know, it's going to be one that people are like, this is a cause that I'm interested in and I want to support. And it's really about his story. It's about his story of trying to become a filmmaker while on the autism spectrum. And I'm excited about it. It's a really great script. So it's the first time I've kind of signed on just to be a producer of something for a long time. And so, yeah, I got a lot of things in the fire. I was talking to just recently Lauren Hadaway, who made a movie called The Novice that came out a year or so ago. It's a really fantastic movie. But she had said, I had her talking to some of my students, and she said, making movies are like having children in the 1880s. You just kind of have to have a lot of them because you know that most of them aren't going to live to adulthood. And you love them, but you know that some of them are going to die. And I thought that was so brilliant and so perfect that I've been quoting it ever since. So I've got a lot of young
nothing
children.
Is more true. And I remember, I don't know which guru, maybe it was even some, like, I don't forget who it was, but yeah, I remember when I was in college in the 80s and there was a film studies professor, he said, screenwriting is killing your children because you got to write that first draft and then you just got to start killing people off. It is a brutal art form. But then again, I'm sure Picasso would tell you I've ripped up more canvases than I've shared.
Picasso, another Picasso quote was, art is as much about destruction as it is about creation. I think that,
you know, I don't know if you can tell, I'm a huge Picasso guy.
Oh, good.
Which every time I've been to Europe, I've been like, just as much Picasso as I can get. But I don't know why I'm bringing it up, but boy, when the Me Too stuff hit, I was like, oh.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah.
You know, I can't be too, I got to separate the artist from their disgusting side because.
Yeah.
Because my man Pablo, way did not treat women well. What can I say?
No, he did not. Yeah, it's a tricky thing. That's a whole tricky thing because you know, as someone said to me recently, all of our heroes have clay feet.
Yeah.
So, you know.
For sure. All right. Well, feels like a good time to stop, although we didn't get into the stuff that we preambled about Powerless. But, you know, people should watch it. It's on YouTube.
Super Powerless is available on YouTube. I put it up there. You know, I had a VOD contract, you know, where it was at all the Amazon and Peacock. Well, I don't know if it was on Peacock, but Amazon and cable systems
and
all the different places, so you could get on and rent it. And then I guess that contract ended, and it wasn't available anywhere, you know, because there wasn't a DVD that you could buy, and there wasn't, you know, all of a sudden you just couldn't see it because once that contract was gone, the movie wasn't available anywhere. So I was like, screw this, I'm just going to put it on YouTube. And so that's been great, is that I could just say, hey, watch my movie. It's available for free. I mean, it had outlived its time when it was making any money back. Not like it ever made a ton, but, you know, it wasn't really bringing in much. So might as well just get eyes on it. So that's there. And Omeletto will be hosting 30 Meetings, 30 Days for now. And you and I will talk again and get it on your system soon. And
hopefully that person who that public person whose permission you need, maybe they'll watch 30 Meetings and go, oh, this guy knows what he's doing.
And absolutely I will be sending it along as my work sample for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful calling card, I think.
Yeah, thank you.
Excellent. Well, should people, well, first of all, if you go to YouTube, people just have to go to Duane, and that's D-U-A-N-E. Duane Makes Movies.
Right.
Is your YouTube for them to find your stuff.
Yeah, I'm at Duane Makes Movies on YouTube, on Facebook, on Instagram. I'm not on Twitter. I don't have enough to say to be on Twitter. But yeah, so Duane Makes Movies.
Perfect. All right. Well, with that, I will now ramble off the stuff I'm supposed to ramble about to close it out. And how do I do that? I forgot. But good thing is I have notes. All right. Well, you just got to hear Dwayne Anderson talk all about his film, 30 Meetings, 30 Days. 30 Meetings / 30 Days, if people want to be specific. We never mentioned the slash, actually. But anyhow, we took home 6 awards at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival. I think I already mentioned the TV series, but I'll just quickly say thank you for listening to the Discover Indie Film podcast. There is a TV series that was born out of this podcast because I kept talking to filmmakers and everyone who had a feature, you know, it was on a streaming service, it was somewhere, and everyone who made a short, they really didn't have a home. So Amuleto was a wonderful solution to that problem, but my solution to that problem was the Discover Indie Film TV series on Amazon Prime Video. So if people just go to Prime Video, type in Discover Indie Film, you can enjoy 7, possibly by the time you hear this, 8, now won't be by the time you hear this, but 7 seasons. There might be seasons 8 and 9 might come out later this year. And it's just short films handpicked from the festival circuit. So please watch that and like it and give it a nice review. Like and subscribe to the podcast. All right, I think I've said the Discover Indie Film stuff I need to. So we mentioned Sherman Oaks Film Festival. We hold that every November. And if you want to learn more, it's Sherman Oaks Film, ShermanOaksFF.com or at ShermanOaksFF on social media. And there is another festival that's coming up on me way too fast called Film Invasion Los Angeles. And that one we hold every June. So you can learn more if you go to FilmInvasionLA.com or at FilmInvasionLA. And the last thing not mentioned, although it's funny, here we talked all about 30 meetings, 30 days, is I did start a thing called TV High because, well, I don't have to go into the whole explanation, but if you go to watchtvhi.com, it's a new smart TV app / streaming service where all the content is pretty great to watch if you're stoned or high. It's that's why it's called watchtvhigh.com. I always say this at the end of every podcast. I have a lot of friends in recovery. Sounds like you might too, but I have friends in recovery, and be responsible with drugs and alcohol. They can ruin your life, but they don't ruin everyone's life. If you can do it in a positive way and you're just unwinding at the end of the day and you can't find shit to watch on Netflix or other services, because honestly, I sometimes have a hard time finding shit I enjoy in that state. Give TVHigh.com, watch TV High. This TVHI, it's actually on Roku, Amazon Fire Stick, Apple TV, Android TV, iOS, so iPhone, and Android Mobile. So it's actually, I'm hoping this idea takes off. It'd be fun. And actually, it is $4.20 a month if you sign up at watchtvhigh.com. So that's TVHI. And I think that's all I got to say. I think we're good.
All right. It's been a pleasure.
Been a pleasure. Thank you, Dwayne. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And actually, the podcast right after this one will be fun because you get to hear Dwayne answer the 4 questions about favorite films and stuff. So thank you, everyone, for listening.